And I'll just tell you a few of the things that have happened out of here. One parish quite near in this state, another parish fairly distant in San Francisco, both of them, independently of knowing each other were doing this, went from the village, for example, and got their entire parish involved in evening art classes, of all the crazy things. And you may wonder, what in the world, you know? But if you're around the village for a week, you won't wonder what in the world. And instead of picking on each other and backbiting and fighting each other, suddenly they were excited, they were enjoying their pastor, and there was a whole new morale in the parish as they were painting together. Now this may sound corny to some of you, but they were seeing God's present world as their gift. They were seeing the mystery of one another and how differently they looked at this world as they even saw each other's paintings. And they were involved in something else besides trying to paint the pastor into a red, which some of the people in this parish were doing because they were extreme right-wingers. Or one of them incidentally converted up here this summer. I didn't even know the guy. And he says, no, I agree with your position. I said, that I never want. The church has got big enough for right-wingers as left-wingers. But I said, I only wanted you to deal with this in love and not hostility and fear. And this particular parish had a tremendous experience, as well as the one in California, on just this one little thing. And finally, my final little note, which I mean all sincerity, is that I think the parish has to, even in its structure, its architecture, its planning, its activity and so on, be a parish which is saying hello to the world and not saying to hell with the world. And that in a way in which your life is organized, structured together, there must be some way in which you're saying hello to the world, in which the world feels at ease with you, is able to come in with you, mingle with you, and so on. And I know of nothing better at this, as I say, than to have a community sauna on Saturday night, show a movie that all of them can look at and enjoy and discuss, and have a little chance to eat together and to actually relate to one another, where they don't have to know, when do I sit down, when do I stand up, when do I say amen, is it glory to thee, O Lord, or is it praise to thee, O Christ, I say, when they're going to say now the gospel for the day, and all the rest of this rigmarole, we make it as tough as we can for the world to feel at home with us. And we do. There isn't any other organization selling anything in the world that tries to make its customer ill at ease except the Church of Jesus Christ. It's amazing that we even recruit pagans when you think how tough we make it for. They gotta go for some meetings and even to know our lingo. They gotta learn our language. We don't bother to learn theirs. And then they've got to learn how to sit down and stand up when we do, and make sure they do it right, or they're going to feel self-conscious and embarrassed and wish they'd never come around. You realize the fact that poor fellows had nothing, and Holden Village gets about 350 to 400 pagans a summer. And so we know what we're talking about, that the fellows had nothing, no religious background or anything else. He just doesn't know where to begin. But when he can do what you're doing, when he can take a sauna with you, look at a movie with you, or have a laugh in with you, or enjoy something just simply together with you, you create a basis on which you're saying hello to the world, in which he can say hello to you. And then something we believe wonderful can happen. We believe even many people have to be surprised into Holy Communion, that to have it only at certain moments, which make it almost at a distance between the people who are to participate and this event together is wrong. And it's somehow midnight, for instance, and you've got those young adults there, and some of them haven't been to communion since they were confirmed, and they feel they just don't belong, but they've come into this kind of jolly Saturday night fellowship, or at midnight, why not have a communion service? Right in their midst. And allow the Lord to eat with publicans and sinners, as he did here on the earth, because that's when he had communion. This is some of our little throw out here. And I just start that to begin. Now I'll take it over. Norm's sitting here still, so we'll let the prophetic blast take place here. And then you just all pick it up. Some of you are doing interesting things, and we'd like to hear from you. Got something you'd like to say, Norman, on this business of the shape of the parish for its 20th century mission?
Well, right about now, I'm just sort of sitting here in my cold and not feeling too prophetic at the moment. There are a lot of exciting things happening in the church. One of the most exciting that I think is moving into a lot of things in the church is what are called sensitivity training groups, small T groups that are related to psychology. But some of us have done new forms of this which are do not just revolve around the psychological dimension of it, but revolve around the faith dimension of it. We call them listening groups or new life groups, things like this, where a small group in the congregation, maybe 50 people, divide up into 10 groups, five groups of 10 each, and then that group will meet whatever time suits the 10 people, and have for about 10 weeks, you make a commitment that you will meet those nights for 10 weeks, and then you sit down, and we began, the way we did it, was with take one chapter of, say, Matthew, and you had to listen to that chapter and read it over and over during the week, and listen to what you think bothered you, what you couldn't really face when you read it, when God talked to you. Try to listen to what was being said there. And then we came back into the group and let the people in the group say very honestly, what was the thing that really hit you about this chapter? What was the thing that was the biggest problem that you saw? And out of that, begin to start being honest about our faith and our doubts and our feelings one to the other, and a discussion of honesty, learning to feel each other and know each other and this kind of thing. That's one of the things that has really been bringing alive a certain number of people today. The sensitivity groups, training groups, are done sometimes on a pure psychological level, but when they are used in church can be a force for simply discovering other people, what it means that someone else is a Christian. And one day, for example, and we said, all right, next week, instead of finding out, telling us what you felt was a difficulty with this chapter, why don't you say what it was that really helped you? And that was hard. It was very hard for many people to say exactly how Christ had helped them in the words that week. I found it difficult to say how he really related. And it was interesting as people finally got to be honest about their faith to one another. And finally, when they see each other and see that there are certain things that they have in common, they begin to ask, well, how can we help each other to do what we are to be, to say what we have to say, and be the church? And if you're not honest, you're in trouble. If you keep wearing masks, you're in trouble as a church. And this is part of the problem of the church. We have masks to the outside world, too. This is one little thing, for example, that I throw into the hopper as particularly useful in some of the new forms of the church that are happening.
Any of you have similar groups happening in your group? Because Christ spoke Candace a week ago saying the thrill they've been having of the same type of a group. And are there any of you that are knowing this? Any of you from Westwood where you have that type of a home?
The program there, I don't belong right now.
Their type of a program there. Now theirs, what I like about theirs is the way in which it's open-ended. Could you just mention this?
Well,
I mean, the way in which new people are continually able to come in every 3 months,
mm-hmm.
who have been outside of
the group, and there's four couples, I believe.
Four couples to each group.
And then at the end of the 3 month period, they divide, and
mm-hmm.
two other couples invite two other couples to join them and make a group of four, I mean of eight people, mm-hmm. four couples.
Every 3 months they multiply. Now, incidentally, they invite neighbors, they invite non-Christians, they get pagan friends, because everybody is sort of interested in what does the Bible say, you know. And so you've got this for hooked. Now, there, the way they organize theirs is they have about a 2.5 hour fairly structured conversation in that they do have a mimeographed sheet beginning to prepare, and the couples who've been with it all along they started off, and it's in one of their homes, and then the next month it's in another one who've been with it. And then it goes into the new ones, you see. And then, so that those who've been with it give it its initial kind of a punch. And they have a tremendous number of people involved with it. And one reason why Oldham Village is always having people from Westwood is because of these groups, unquestionably. This feeds them again and strengthens them for what they know. Now, the Strongs and the Voights, who just went out of here today, are from that particular parish and show something what these groups have meant. It's a dirty word in St. Louis Park to be called a suburbanite. I mean, these people have been confronting this whole suburbia complex with Jesus Christ and what it means to be disciple in that situation. And they really have it in. Then at 10:30, they invite in one of the pastors or someone who is in the congregation, who is knowledgeable in the scripture, to aid them in any unresolved questions. And they have from 10:30 to 12 with a little lunch and talking over these things. Now, that's how they do it. It's an 8 to 12 thing once a month. But I just mentioned this as one of those, just means. This is not like the Bethel Bible study. It's using the scripture for fellowship, using it for exposure, using it to get unbound from the law and released in the gospel and encouraging each other in Christ. And it's a method that any congregation can use. You don't have to send anybody to Madison to learn it. It's something that is you can set up locally and tailor-make for you. Now, do any of the rest of you have? Now, I mentioned one congregation in Spokane like this and one in Minneapolis, some others. This is the kind of thing hope will have. Here we are.
To begin this, now, I was just wondering how this thing really starts at the beginning, or you initiate this. You said something about a mimeograph sheet.
Yeah. This is what they had there. Now, there they had a particular member of their church who took this upon himself as his particular ministry to the church, and he just made this his. Now, that's the way they use there. The one in Spokane doesn't use anything like this. They simply meet and relate to each other in love, relate some of the difficulties they've been having in this period they haven't been having, or some things they'd like to have a chance to share a little, pray a little about. Then they read the scriptures and discuss the scriptures, Hobble says here, and what fits me here, see? What do I see here? I may say in all my parishes, I've used every Saturday night this way, for men only. And it's been a tremendous thing for me. I mean, this has girded up my ministry on Sunday morning. And then finally, so many men coming, I couldn't begin to get them all in the house, so then I've split them up amongst their homes, finally. But at first, starting off with just those who come, two or three, you know, and find them continually increasing. The one thing about these is we've all discovered they do grow. There's a real hunger for this kind of, well, his word sensitivity is a good one, inner sensitivity, that someone to whom you can talk without feeling it becomes a matter of gossip, you know. Someone to whom you can expose yourself who doesn't say, ha-ha, that's the kind of a guy you are, you know. But who says, boy, you felt that way? That's the way I felt too, you know. In other words, this kind of an inner structural relationship. Some more?
I wanted to ask a question about, did you say once a month?
That's the way Westwood does it,
yeah. So it'd be just three meetings for the group?
Yeah, and then they break it up again. What they like about this there is that it doesn't create an in-group. See? No one can feel I'm on the outside. Every 3 months, new couples come in. See?
It must be 4 months, because each one of the couples three. Have a chance to entertain
them, see? No, the new one doesn't. What they used to do, now they may have changed. What they did at first was three were old-timers, one was new each time, and the new one didn't entertain until it was their second time around. Then they took it over on the second time around. That's how they were doing it. Now, they may have changed since because so many have become involved in it. They have, I would say, about a third of their whole adult membership involved in these groups now. Yeah, and it started quite small, just actually started with one, you know, and it kept moving. Now they have quite a few. They run about 50 of these. Now, are there some others? Of Bethel, of course, we know, and this certainly we're not denigrating, but this kind of thing, it creates fellowship, creates contact, and allows you to invite somebody whom you wouldn't be able to get to church, but you'll come to your home for this, you see? I remember the first night when my men broke it up in Manitowoc, because we were having over 40 every night, and they had to sit on the floor and on the stairs going up, and finally one of them said, this is crazy. We don't need the pastor around to read the Bible. He doesn't do anything for us here anyway. All he does is read it too. So I didn't prepare anything for him. It was brand new to me. He said, why can't we do this ourselves? I said, I've been waiting for you. So then we started with our 11 deacons, and they all had them in there. And each one of those ran close to 20 or more each time. We had 200 people the very first time they took it over. So the 40 went up to 200. But what was interesting, the very first time they had it, one of the fellows, now originally Missouri Synod, now Missouri Synod again down in Texas, but he was then in our church in Watertown, is actually a mechanic in a garage. Through this kind of a group, he became quite proficient in expression and became a $1 million-a-year man as an insurance man, incidentally, as he grew articulate through this group's experience with each other. But he invited over the people with whom he'd first stayed when he moved to Watertown, who owned the Golden Pheasant Bar. And the fellow was converted that first night. No, it just simply hit him, because it's so fresh. This is the thing. Isn't that the way you discover it? It just comes new. It's like 1 Corinthians says, they say, God is indeed in your midst, and they go on your knees. This kind of a give and take. But it does have to keep, I always say it has to keep the word over it, beware the leaven of the scribe and the Pharisee. The minute you think, now we got all the spiritual people together in the parish in this little group, it's through. God's going to destroy it. It's had its day. But when you meet somebody because you need it, see, like we do here on Wednesday and Saturday nights at midnight, if there are 10 there or 20 there, we couldn't care less, you know. We need it, that's all. The trouble is why this failed, incidentally, amongst our immigrant groups, this was a real thing we were talking about. This is what our earliest parishes really were. The parish life was this way. And then as we lost the sense of being strangers in a strange land and talked the new language and became proficient in making money in the new land too, and status developed amongst us, so we weren't all pretty much on the same basis, all broke and making our way in the new land, you know, when that thing changed, then you got this subtle shift in our parish life as well, and where we became sort of a Sunday morning fellowship. But really, for many of those parish churches, one of my grandfathers had 37 congregations, for example. You know about how often they met on Sunday morning. But they had meetings themselves every week, amongst themselves, in just this way. Then when he came, it was the baptism, the time for Holy Communion, and the time to marry those who were already having kids, and all the rest of it, you know. But that's how it was back in the last century amongst our immigrants. But this kind of day, weekly fellowship, this they had, is a very real thing. And I think like one of the men said, one of the laymen who had a good deal to do these in his day, and in running, his name is, and a man without whom I would not be in Christ today, I'll admit. But he said, what these groups did is that when one was depressed, another one would be up and he'd carry him, you see? And so they were carrying a brother. Some guy had been defeated and fallen and stumbled and gotten all messed up in something. He was carried by the rest, you know. He wasn't hit down or felt to be outside. This real fellowship together that kind of carried each other. And it's what this is what we mean by our Wednesday and Saturday night groups here. We encourage one another in the promises, that's all. Simply encouraging one another to believe what God declares. And this does bring a new spurt to a parish. It's tremendous, I think, what it will mean. You can have different kinds. We have a little group. I'll express from ourselves it means much to us. We don't meet too often. We don't even meet once a month. We meet when all five of us are in town with our wives. And what started us off was that Life magazine and the same issue that you had the picture of these fellows, these deputy sheriffs and the sheriff, you know, that had been apprehended for killing off this guy in the down there in this freedom deal. And that leer on their faces, you know, they knew no law would get them. They just sitting there with that leer. And then you had also those missionaries down in the Congo who had their intestines eaten while they were watching. You know, they were still alive as these people who had simply slit open their stomachs and were eating their intestines in front of them. Well, in both of these situations, you had a feeling of the demonic made visible. Really, didn't you? And when we looked at this, Merton Strumman and I, we said, boy, we haven't been praying. And we haven't. And so we just got this for a little fellowship and prayer. And Strumman and his wife, and Paul Bowen and his wife, who's over in headquarters, Ray Johnson and his wife, who's a layman in the youth office, and Larry Goodniston, who's Lutheran Welfare, and Mary and myself. And we meet, we just share for half an hour on the concerns that are making us feel heavy of heart or depressed, situations in the church's life, headquarters, some of these things, families involved in the headquarters group oftentimes who don't have too many praying for them. And then we go into prayer for an hour or so. Just pray around, continue to feed it back, issues in our national life and so on. Then we end up with a little lunch there too and share different homes. This is another kind of fellowship like this. We don't ever study the scriptures here. We meet specifically just for intercession.
Well, I think we've been talking enough here. One of the things about these groups is that you learn to listen to somebody. What we find if you're at a social gathering, you don't really listen to somebody. All you do is you wait for your turn to speak and make your big point so you can build yourself up. And you don't really listen to someone, what they're really saying or what they're feeling. Listening to people's feelings and their inner selves and what they are. Maybe we can just throw it back at you now and say, instead of giving you these ideas, maybe we can feed it by asking you what do you think you would like to see happening in the parishes, so that we're listening to your side of it. Some of you who are just there wondering why we are saying so much, maybe. What are some of the things you find that you'd like to see happening? What are some of the problems you see in the parish today?
Yeah?
Well, I can tell you an incident that happened in Seattle. We no longer belong to the church there, but there's a friend of mine and I had another friend. He got into pretty serious trouble with the law. And he was one of these type of people that, well, he's lost, he's a bastard, nobody to turn to, et cetera, you know. So the people in the church, there was a group of five or six fellows got together and talked this person into coming into the church. And they formed kind of a old Alcoholics Anonymous type thing. Whenever this fellow started feeling depressed or needed help, any time of the day or night, these people were willing to have him call. And they come over and talk to him.
Great.
And it worked.
Yeah. Great. One of the novels we'll be reading in September by Charles Williams is based on that kind of a plot. Mm-hmm. So that's happening.
This week's magazine of every 2 weeks tomorrow, I think. They had an article on the fishes. Is anyone familiar with it? It's evidently these offices have been set up around different places in the United States. They're manned 24 hours a day. They do not dispense funds, nor do they have funds, other than somebody picks up the tab for the telephone bill every month. And people can call there and get help. They'll be, or can be told where they can get help. And it gave examples. One woman whose elderly parents lived 70 miles away, but she couldn't get them on the phone and she was panicky. The fish office in that town, she got a hold of them, they sent someone out. They found that her father had a heart attack and the mother was in shock, helpless too, and they immediately took care of it. There are people who, there was one mother, had five little children, her husband was in Vietnam. She called up one day and she said, I can't stand it any longer, I'm walking on the walls. Well, they got some help. And I think maybe this is something. And as I say, there are no funds involved. If there is
people.
It's people. It's person to person, and like Frank Laubach, the missionary, said, or we need people to be talking.
one rich one. In this group, and with many of these things, I think many times we say, oh, it has to go through the council and the church council. This stops us, though. I mean, we think this, you know. And it's in God's own.
You were speaking about how these study groups and et cetera grow.
Mm-hmm.
This incident I was telling you about, this was the first time that any of our recollection of churches went this far with one of the forum.
I might say that is probably one of the coldest churches I've ever been in my life. We belong to 4 years.
And yet it could do this.
The minister does not call on the parishioners.
Well, that's rather general, but yet you could actually relate this way in love.
Yeah, this is, I don't know, it's not started.
But this
incident
happened, and
I still don't believe it.
It's going to be quite a thing now. There's been several fellows of the congregation that we are acquainted with that have volunteered for these positions. Where before they go to church on Sunday, put the money in the collection plate, and go home.
Mm-hmm. This is what we're concerned about here, is that how does this community reshape itself for the kind of challenges that meet us now? Obviously, Sunday morning is not enough. Some more?
I wonder, does this type of ministry add or subtract from the attendance and the general concern within the main body of the church? What has been the experience of those who had these
does it lead them, he's wondering here, to be more critical of the Sunday morning and they withdraw from it into their own little cozier group, or do they become more involved on Sunday morning? Is that what you're thinking
That's
of?
That's the question.
Yeah.
Well, from what I've heard about, of course I can't speak from personal observations, I haven't been, but the group in this particular church seems to have gotten a lot closer together. They've put themselves in a position to take a deeper concern with the problems of the members of the church than they had before. They realized that they were actually missing something. And or they just weren't putting into practice what they were hearing. A lot of respect. And this, it was kind of a drastic situation that brought this about. And it actually benefited the
If I could venture a guess at this point in the light of our history here, I'd say at first it'll be very positive and strengthened. And then Satan gets his little niche in there that, well, we got the really spiritual people with us and the ones who are really concerned and the rest of these dead beats, you know. And then, of course, it's through. And that's what happened to our prayer meetings. I mean, most of us in the Lutheran parishes of at least the Scandinavian traditions all had a midweek prayer meeting. And it killed them because they were, you know, praying for all the unregenerate who weren't here tonight, you know. And that killed them. Right, Ray? I mean, I'd say this is pretty much, wouldn't you? Remember at St. Olaf when we had the Brotherhood there that we kind of, and it got dull because it was just too aware of itself and too unaware of those who weren't with them. Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to ask is, what are our churches doing to make themselves not only available, but desirable to minority groups?
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question I was hoping that would come. The ones we aren't getting now on a Sunday morning.
That's it. Minority groups especially.
Yeah.
Are we going out to them and reaching out to them, or are we being a real WASP society? And incidentally, the Lutherans are the outs in the WASP society. The Episcopalians are the ins.
Yeah.
But are we sitting there waiting for them to come to us?
Sure.
Our sadly, here we are.
Our announcements in the paper, they can come if they want to.
Yeah.
But are we?
Yeah. Well, that we got the irony on that one.
But
even other Lutherans have hesitate to come because they're afraid they won't be familiar with the liturgy. So how can you expect someone who maybe hasn't been in church?
I happen to be part of a congregation, for instance, an open congregation, always has been, the place where always the bums in Washington when they were converted felt at ease in joining and so on. And though it's been an open congregation all these years, the only people that aren't white are statist people. You know, the Negro family whose son just won the state award for the outstanding scholar in the state, and the Indian family who's definitely on the make and you don't have to feel sorry for them and so on. That's Central Lutheran Minneapolis. And despite the fact they want to, you see, and they're open and they've never had any problem on the integration situation, but it's a congregation which most people come to by car, very few walk to, and the people who walk to it are the minority groups, you know.
Maybe there are some people who actually did move into the city or go to the churches of the minorities in the city instead of just saying, come out to us. Maybe there are some here.
Are there some of you here who've decided to move and change your residence on this issue?
We have a member of Westwood here.
Raleigh will be here now too, of course, in a week. Raleigh Larson will be here, whose whole family shifted gears on this.
Because most of us can't even talk about it because we're all total hypocrites about it. We sit in the suburban area, and if we do go downtown and visit, you know, we come down as benevolent benefactors who are deigning to say we're concerned for a day or two or a Sunday or something, but no real involvement, no really being down in the heart of the problem and living it out. All of us probably are suburban people who are totally superior, thinking that we are somehow, even just because by virtue of the fact that we own a little more property or something, superior. It's just the way we have become. And the only way that we can ever overcome it is to become somehow totally involved with these people. And maybe that's not even possible for us.
Yes.
There was something I saw when we were in La Paz, Mexico. I went to there was no Lutheran church there. I went to Catholic church on Palm Sunday morning. And the regular worshipers came in nicely dressed and stayed for the morning. They could tell they were used to worshiping there. But the back of the church just filled up with men coming off the street. Came in shirt sleeves, came in any kind of clothes they were wearing, overalls or anything, and listened to the service. Now,
What would happen if that would come to pass in our church?
Come to
our church in Salina sometime in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
We get them all.
Yeah. Yeah, this is right. I think the tourist type church today, you can come anyway. And I love Central Lutheran because you can come anyway. But most churches have got a certain section of society, and that's all, don't they? Dominant, and you kind of dress like them and look like them.
This is one thing I run into in particular. My wife and I were construction workers, and we move around a lot. And, we're Lutherans, we're usually accepted pretty well in the churches, but there's always this kind of coldness, or a natural segregation between the people that are in the community that have their roots down there against any transit type.
Oh, brother, amen.
This is a real problem.
How many of the rest of you can share this, what they're saying right here, right now? How many of you are transient members of your communities? Just be fun to see it, and those that come to Holden Village, how many of you are actually transient members? Don't be afraid of it, there's nothing status here. Yeah, there's some hands, it should be more than that. Yeah, well, there you are, this is right. Now, I would say that from our lists, that a good 30% or more of those who come to Holden Village are transient Lutherans. Maybe one of the appeals of Holden is one place where they find a community as they, you know, are mobile. They're moving. Boy, trying to keep up with our addresses, even our workers during the summer. By next February, half of them have got another address.
And you know, it's what we've done quite well by the children. As they've all five have had good instruction, some better than the others. But one place we were at 2 years, there was no instruction. No catechism, no instruction to prepare them to be confirmed. And I was getting pretty panicky because one of the children was a boy, and I had it figured out that if he didn't get to a church pretty soon and get him started in instruction, he was going to fight me. And I wouldn't have fought him. I would have said, I would like you to do this because you fight him at the end. But it was as it was, he was 16. Confirming the oldest one in the class. And that's not
that's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. But you find this in a lot of some of your communities, though they are not geared to a mobile society. And it isn't just they think it's just construction workers and people with trailer houses who move. Let me tell you, it's not. We found out that school teachers move as much as construction
Amen.
Workers.
And in business. No, how many of you are organized to help on this? Because I had a parish in Clear Lake, Iowa, which is the loveliest place in Iowa. And all the big corporations don't send their poorest guys to Iowa. It's good. It is a wealthy area, and they send usually their best men. But that parish absolutely refused to be interested in the people only living in Clear Lake for 2 or 3 years. And yet half the city moved every 3 years. 105 of my core people owned their own farms. And those were the solid citizens. And you couldn't sell them on. And I said, you're paganizing America. These people go up, manage these corporations, become presidents of them. They lived in the town where the Lutheran church was dominant, and they couldn't care less where they were there. But it was awfully hard. I couldn't get through them. I had to quit. In order for me to get through them, I had to resign after 18 and a half months. And then my successor finally could bring them through after I'd shook them up on them.
Well, this is my concern, and it's not primarily on a personal basis.
But that, they aren't even minorities.
Yeah. It's what it's doing to the whole among people who want that the Lutheran faith as a whole.
Yeah.
Because Lutherans, well, it's been my experience, they're a little funny. If there's not a Lutheran church around,
they don't go.
No, that's just right. Generally true.
Well, sometimes you run into the fact, too, on we moved into an area where it was only one synod was available. It was different from the one we had belonged to before. And we asked the pastor about taking communion. The first thing he said was,
did you lie? Maybe we need, like we sort of do in the chaplaincy, that we don't ask those questions. We agree in the chaplaincy to treat them all,
yeah.
Right? And I think in our mobile society, we're going to have to face that because we have, all of us, our parishes are moving. Go ahead.
And our church in Mountain View and Calvin, we may have changed our constitution and bylaws to the effect that non-Lutherans can take communion and they won't be breaking up any of the old church regulations that have been hanging fire for so many years. This came about as you might call a minor revolution.
Major
proportion. My wife and myself were a little bit in on this. We were raised in other churches other than Lutheran, and we've been Lutherans for 3 years now. And several other families came in that were also non-Lutheran, but were other church background. And we felt that taking of the communion was, well, we raised a little differently. It's church's open communion. And this was a responsibility or a relationship with God in partaking of the communion. So we didn't pay too much attention to the church regulations on the matter. We just went ahead and took communion anyway. And of course, it's kind of made things boil amongst the old timers. And brought a lot of discussion, come to find out that we weren't the only ones, that others that have been at church for 10, 15, 20 years and had done the same thing in the past, but just hadn't said anything about it or anything. So there came the realization that this is the way it is. I mean, it's a relationship with God, as well as the worshipers, as long as the person involved taking communion knew pretty well what they were doing. And also, I might add, too, on this other bit, about minorities. There was something started in our church a short while back that in exchange, a Negro child, well, I should say a child, a teenager, that came out and stayed a weekend with one of the families in the church, and their child, in turn, went and stayed with them the next weekend and went to their church. And this has been reciprocal among several families.
No, this is minorities' problem. Here you come in a little bit. Now, this has been exciting. We had one group here from Buckley, which is a tiny little village of 300, and one of our inner city churches down in Minneapolis sent about 30 Negroes up to that town here last summer. They were just talking about to be guests and with the members in the parish and live a summer out on the farms and see them, and so that this rural North Dakota town would actually have a Negro contingent in its midst. And it was exciting for them.
And how many of the North Dakota people sent their children into the inner city to live with a Negro ghetto?
Of course, here they have it, but we had that last summer too, but I will fight a little bit on that unless they stay with them. I mean, it's just an experiment, you know. I hate to have an experiment on the poor.
These are token things that very often don't really get at the root of the problem and are token actions.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I don't know if this is anything, but to a point that a bunch of us in Chicago were concerned about the racism, set up dialogue kind of things with women in the suburbs, suburban churches. And I had to leave just when it was getting going, but it was just an exchange of knowledge and awareness and concern. So that the suburbs didn't, the people in the suburbia didn't feel it like they were coming to the city to make a big splash, you know. But white people trying to help white people deal with their racism in the church instead of trying to solve their conscience by the black person. And how can the white suburban parish deal with its racism in white suburbia? You know, that's the problem, not coming into the black ghetto and trying to solve their problem.
Another point I mentioned too, that Lutherland in our area, Lake Killarney, also has a Negro boy working on the grounds. And the manager of the of Lutherland is a member of our church also, which is a little instrumental in getting him there in the first place. He's a local boy, and there are a few Negroes that live in this area. And also, we have an ex-convict in our church, and quite well accepted. And I don't think you get much broader than that. But of course, he has a very high position. He's the Washington State Regional Director of the Seventh Step Foundation, which you may or may not have heard of. It's an organization founded to work with rehabilitating ex-convicts. In the state of Washington, they're not allowed yet to go into the prisons to work with the convicts before they're discharged, like they are in some states, because they're not as well recognized. In some of the other states that the organization is working, they're allowed to go into the prisons and work with them. And this is, it's not a, how would you say, a Christian-backed organization. That is, there isn't any organization backing it. It's an organization itself, founded by Warden Clinton Duffy and Bill Sands. based on the belief that there's somebody bigger than they are, and that someone that cares for them. God. And with this, it's something on an alcoholic anonymous sort of thing in a way. Still different. But they have been successful with 80% of the people that they've been able to, 80% of the convicts they've been able to get in contact with. They have been able to, they haven't rehabilitated, but they've been instrumental in showing them the way. Become rehabilitated to become acceptable by society, as well as for them to accept society. Because they have to accept society before society will accept them. And they have to realize this. They have to be want to be accepted. And they have ways of getting jobs for them.
We'll relax with each other now and just share, because this is what stimulates you to go and do likewise and discover other ways of doing it. There can be many different ways. One member down in actually the Kansas City area was just saying that they thought maybe what they got most out of Holden Village, a night like this, when another from California just shared the fact that they had a church without debt that went and put a debt on their church to enable another church to get going. And so they went back and sold their Kansas City one on it. Well, just little things like this, you can share together that kind of trip things up to allow the church to be more faithful in fulfilling her mission to this 20th century.
Because we don't have any money, but we won't
event, we won't go into the area and say, join.
What about you and your family yourself?
I suppose they're Tom.
Well, I attended a Lutheran congregation right by the University of Chicago, and that's in the heart, right in the middle of Negro ghettos in Tucson. What happened there is one elderly lady became convinced that it was necessary to go out and try to get Negro kids in the Sunday school. And she was retired, and she just spent, I think, half of her days doing this. And she built up the Sunday school until about 40% of the children were Negro. And then some of the parents would join the church. And it was through contacts like this that the congregation really became integrated.
Yeah,
then the congregation also sponsored a basketball team in the community. They got kids to play on that. And I think there was a little bit of a tutoring program, but not much of a one. But it was primarily the Sunday school and the basketball.
I don't know if this, I worked in the suburbs.
This is really,
it was very ineffective, with most people as far as this kind of thing. And then I had to get out of the suburbs into the city and saw it in a completely different, life. But maybe you don't go around trying to change people's minds anymore. I mean, this is where I'm at. I go to the people who listen. When Martin Luther King got killed, I decided my action would be to go back to where I was and tell them like it was, in the city. It was pretty, to be able to tell them the truth. But I could do it a little bit easier because I didn't have to live with the consequences. I could get out of it. But I don't know. I think you get with the people who will listen. That's the starting point. You find the other people who have the same concerns you do.
Do you do things like forget about the church program and say, quit talking to these people and say, okay, bring it up every time there's a Bible study or bring it up whenever they're talking about what are the problems of the church? Are we past the point of talking? Maybe what I should rather do is find, say, five people in the congregation, as you say, who will listen and join the Fair Housing Council.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is this is the time for this kind of thing. To talk to a bigot and say you shouldn't be a bigot is ridiculous. It's against your grip. But to demonstrate, maybe, in your own life, doing your own thing, he will be able to see.
By joining the Fair Housing Council, that's the last of that church about.
What?
Joining the Fair Housing Council, I might be, unofficially excommunicated. It'll be rather interesting.
All right, well, then you'll have a chance to see it.
I'm in Riverside, though.
Yeah.
That would be, I suppose,
that's a good one. Yeah.
And one thing that we've been doing in the last couple of months is interracial dialogue. By just happenstance, we are fortunate enough to have four Negro families in the congregation. Some of them, not because we were so evangelical, we got them, they just came for us. Some of them are articulate. They're not common. And they're accepted by the congregation, so we were able to dialogue, certainly with a small, I suppose, 25% of the most of the congregation that are involved in this, but at least some of them got help and got out of the congregation. Are in turn talking, working with their friends on a personal level and helping them kind of on the basis that. Also, along with it, we were able to invite in then some other Negroes from the side of the congregation, Black National, Northern, and some others. Not because I, as pastor, brought them in, but because the group as they met thought we ought to hear this. And they invited them. And it's really I expect it hasn't come yet. Really, some good things have happened. So it's just a start.
I think your black families live in the same area that you're up to. I mean, our one black family, you know, they come over from the Pacoima ghetto and join us on Sunday morning. And fortunately for the congregation, I feel, you know, very justified because he also is a head usher once in a while, you know. And they feel so good when he walks down the aisle and say, wow, and I heard him. And that really, it really makes you think after a while that they can feel really good about this one family and have 6,000. Not all these 6,000 are unchurched, but there are a good many of them unchurched. We have about 80% unchurched in San Fernando Valley. So you know that there are lots of them that aren't in any church.
But could that one Negro family that it be known that other Negroes are welcome?
But they're not, I think.
And if that one Negro family in turn invite their friends.
Well, I mean, you know, they come.
Maybe if you could get the congregation is proud of this Negro family, they evidently wanted to get bigoted, so maybe you could get them involved somehow in the, I know a program in the Minneapolis church that seems to be working really well, where one girl has sort of feeling shy, and she's called all the people she can lay out in the congregation who might be interested, and she's paired them up with children from a local school that has a lot of minority children. And she did that by working through the social worker in the school. And so she paired them up, big brother, little brother, big sister, little sister. And that has advantage over the tutorship program in that you don't have a relationship of teacher to child, because that is, you know, normally very bad in bad school. But you have a relationship of a friend to a friend, a one-to-one relationship. And you call up this child weekly or as often as you can spare the time, and you arrange to go to the zoo, do something, you know, inexpensive, common, ordinary. But you make a friend of him, and pretty soon you find him calling you, you know, just to chat. And you learn a lot about minorities. I don't know. If they're as bad as you say, they might not be interested. But if they don't realize how they feel about it, this is a good way to find out.
You know, the thing that I have to keep catching myself on with peers, suburban peers especially, is I become very prejudiced against suburban prisons. And that's just as bad a bag as they're being prejudiced against black people. And so you have to watch it when you say, when you look at a person and say, oh, you're bigots and stuff. Those are the people you might hear.
Well,
but how can, the prisoners, how can you seek out, you know, the people that are concerned or quiet or don't know what to do?
Have more authority.
We accidentally found some people who were concerned. We're in an all-white integrated church in San Mateo, California. There's no black. But we've started this project, Summer Hope, that the Lutheran Church is trying to come around with. And we've kind of shaken the foundation in our church. We've had these kind of meetings, and this gets back to what we were talking about before. Cottage meetings within the congregation. And there's just no way we can get too many people yet. I say these people, myself included. But we have established Human Relations Committee on the council of the church. And I hope this will help. We've been working through the fair housing council to get as much information as we can to get to our congregation, to pull it to the congregation, to at least let the outside community, not so much the black community, but the white community, know the concern. But like I say, I don't know what kind of direction this is going to take yet, because it's just very important.
Well, San Mateo is kind of, one of those elite communities, huh? It's a lot more elite than Tacoma. Nobody wants to live in Tacoma.
Yeah, we have a black community. We do have a black community. Yeah.
So do you really?
Yeah.
Well, very nicely. You keep it well.
Yeah, they're down. Oh, yeah, they're off.
This probably one of the things that makes this so hard to deal with is that your Negro people, many of them do not accept each other. And I'll give you a point. When we were living in Seattle, I became acquainted with a third grade Negro teacher, a delightful person. And I went to, we lived just next door to the school, and one day I saw her down there right after school, and I went down with a cup of coffee and a couple of cookies, and we sat there and talked. And she was concerned about something, and I just asked her what she was worried about, and she said, well, the little girl you saw leaving here, just as you came in the door, came back to the class here and asked me if she could take home a newspaper. And I let her take it home, but what she really needed, this was a little Negro girl, what she really needed was a reading book. She said she's a transfer, and she cannot read a first grade reader. And this teacher probably was more concerned than a white teacher would have been, because she realized how hard it was going to be for this child. Number one, she was black. Number two, she couldn't read. And I said, well, could you write a note to her mother and ask her to come and see you, and maybe between the two of you can help her. She said, I have talked to the mother once. She says, if I were to send a note home, that mother would look at that note and say, and who does that educated nigger think she is? And that would be the mother. Mm-hmm. So, and I said, is this common? And she said, and she was one I cared very deeply about her. She was proud. She was single. She was proud. She was pretty. This is a problem.
Our school principals in our community have three that I know of, have actually made a pilgrimage to the east, Midwest, and to the south, and to the east part of the United States, and part of the United States, to recruit Negro teachers from into the San Mateo County area.
Yeah, California has lots of Negroes, but none of the Negroes that we raise up through our own school systems ever manage to make it into teaching. We have to import them from the South.
And they want to we can't get that many, though, because we're not paying as well as the
because they can't afford to go to the state colleges. Why? Yeah. Yeah. What I was suggesting by the Fair Housing Council, see, was the idea that, Carol was saying, we need to have these fellowship groups. what I feel is often very quite lacking in the church is you can go there like, you know, five times a week and never find the fellowship. I mean, because you get all hung up in meetings and parish boards and all kinds of things like that. You know? If we went to church and found the fellowship that was supposed to be there, then it seems to me we ought to really be able to be free to do something outside, you know, not spend all our time in that building. I find myself doing this.
Well, that's what we told these people at these cottage meetings that we had. We had about 12 cottage meetings all told in a two-week span. And when we were contacting people to have these cottage meetings, of course, we ran into some staff. But we did been able to, get some people to do it. And we told these people that the worst thing that they could do would be to keep it within the church.
Yeah, but that's another night of the week, so you've got...
this was in the middle of the week.
Yeah, well, that's Wednesday night, let's say. And there's Thursday night choir practice, and there's parish boards in there, you know, and if you're on something else.
Well,
we've had more enthusiasm on this for the people that have been in it, though, and we've had a greater rapport with these people that were involved, and I thought from what you said, is this, you have to get to the people who are interested, and it's amazing the people who are interested, and how all of a sudden you know these people, and you can talk to them, and you can feel an empathy with them, which you've been, people that have been in that church for years that we didn't even know, and we've been there practically since it started, but it has gotten so big, and yet all of a sudden there was a group of people that were really interested, and I knew that it could be dangerous, as he said, we can become elite in ourselves, you know, here we are patting ourselves on the back, and there is this danger because it's just starting, but it's been a wonderful thing, and that's
it's pretty good for me.
We
got a small group. We got a small group, and we're able to push this thing through the council because a lot of the council, members were on vacation. And it was Tennessee. We're able to do more, I think, because it was during the summer. Then we could have accomplished, I think, during the full council. But we have found out that there wasn't any heavy opposition to this thing, but that people just stayed away. It would just drift off. Yeah, well, this is why we're able to do this. This is why we're able. Those who did get together, those of us who did band together in this thing, rather than just have a black preacher come and talk to us between services or something like that, we started this whole program. This is what a lot of churches do. I've done. As maybe there's some people here in the group that know some churches that, while the Lutheran, this is the ALC, has gotten behind this project. So I hope some of the local churches just will bring a speaker and they'll say something and then it'll be it. And I'm not trying to debate anything as far as our own church is concerned, but this thing might fall flat on its face. But I think we'll leave the church done. But we have...
There's too many people branching off, getting
all
ideas, going
out. It started out with just a small group, and it's blossoming out, and it's not so much within our own church, but other people are interested. We've been able to meet the president of Fair Housing Council, and this we would never have done had it not been for the program. And we have met some wonderful colored people in our area, and they are aware of the concern. And this one man that we had at the place, he said that, he said, I can't talk to you people, meaning us in the group. He says, there are just too many scars in my stomach. I just couldn't heal them by talking to you people, but I work with the youth. means himself. Yeah. And he is. He's involved in the Little League, and he's involved in a thing called HELP. And I wish I could remember HELP, one of his initials. I can't remember all his initials, but it's what it's got. It means
employment.
Just no, it's not employment. It's education for the young kids, the fifth grade on down.
Higher education, leadership, participation.
Well, tell me that. Anyway. And it's Mr. Pratt. He's a rug cleaner in somewhere down in that area.
He teaches white people.
And he's a foreman out there. But he's been working with the young kids, both black and white. And I think this is where the area is. I think most of us are pretty well lost as far as our racial prejudices are concerned. I don't think that we can really do anything about our own particular prejudices other than just bring them to the surface.
No, I think one of these things. I mean, we sit here and we talk about all these things we can do, and you know, there's a little story from the book, The Ugly American, that keeps running through my mind when we're talking about helping. And that's the story of the woman, the American woman, who saw these native people all bent over from sweeping with these little short-handled brooms. So she made herself a broom with a long handle. Well, she could have been like most Americans and made one for everybody in the village, because she knew how to do it and she knew where the bamboo was to do it with. Mm-hmm. Instead, she took them to where this bamboo grew. They cut it, they brought it back, and she showed them how to make a broom. Well, now, this is great. I mean, we can do all of these things. We can go to the Fair Housing Board, we can go to the school board and say, well, now we've got to have Negro teachers, this, that, the other thing. But unless we take these people with us and show them this is how it operates, and let them have their say and see that they are heard, we aren't doing any good.
Take what people.
Yeah, we can't just make them white.
No, I know that.
They're way ahead of us.
I know, but they know that they have. If we're going to do it in a society without riot and without turmoil, don't we have to show them that when they want to change, we decide what the change is, a group of us go together and go to the city council, whatever the body is, whether it's church, city council, or whatever it is. Don't we show them, instead of doing it for them, is what we do.
Or let them show us.
Aren't we hung up every time we say they?
Well, I thought that was a good pronoun.
Well, it's good. Yeah, well, that's education on both.
Boy, that really got through. He said, the Negro man that was in our house, he said, whenever anybody says to me, those people, he uses me right there. Mm-hmm. He said, don't ever say them or those people. This just cuts it off. He says, I don't hear anything they say from then on. He says, I'll take your money, but I don't hear anything they say from then on.
You might get a little insight on this Negro situation. Church, how many of you people here have ever attended a Negro Lutheran church?
Well, we are going to. In fact, we came up here and had a lot of enjoyment.
She's talking about the Negro.
Yeah, in Seattle, the Missouri Senate has a, what they call an interracial church. Interracial, 90% Negro, 5% Oriental, and the rest are white. But
so the whites are running away, see.
But they have tried. And the reason we got associated with it, we had a pastor in Longview who moved to Seattle and took over the pastor of this church. And a year before that was when you moved. But I think a person ought to go to a church of this nature to get the Negro's feeling of coming into an all-white congregation.
Mm-hmm.
When you really, begin to understand it.
One thing that's come out of this whole thing is that we have been invited to an African Episcopal. AME Baptist. And we have been invited down to this church for potluck suppers. And it's not just a potluck supper, but what they do is they have a potluck supper, and then they break up into groups, like we are in, and just talk to them, you know, back and forth. And I think this is the best start that we can have.
That's what I say. Psychological education on both white and black. We're not ready to live together yet, psychologically or sociologically, either one.
Seems to me that the churches say they're doing all these wonderful things, you know.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, let's say, a decision which might really change living areas, or let's say an attempt to break into a to integrate, let's say, school sections, then these same people who at church say that they're really working for the integrated church vote no on busing, which is an attempt to break down ghetto areas, vote no on changing boundaries, you know, have a fit and walk down to the city schools offices and demand that their children not be sent to McClay Junior High, which is a pretty well integrated school, and be sent instead to Mount Gleason, which really is overcrowded and doesn't have as good an education, but also doesn't have as good. I mean, it seems to me that the people in the church, when they're outside of the church, are acting the way they really are. In the church, they're out and out hypocrites. Even when they say that they, you know, even when they stand in silence for Martin Luther King, they really don't mean it. They're really saying how they finally got that trouble.
Mm-hmm. Or they're not thinking anything about it at all.
Yeah. How many of you have read the book Death at an Early Age by Stanley Kovel? You should read it. It's frightening. It tells of a teacher in the Boston Public Schools in 1965 or 66. The majority of the children were Negro. There were some Jewish. His teacher was Jewish. Next. He tells about one little Negro boy who was retarded. He was taken to the basement and beaten because he couldn't learn. And it was written right on his card that he was retarded. And there were incidents like this all the time.
Well, he was finally thrown out of school, yeah. Wasn't he? And the reason he was thrown out of that school was because he wanted to live down with his students. And the school board said, no, you can't live. And finally, he's I guess he's living in the suburbs now and commuting into the ghetto to teach. I've heard about this guy, but I didn't read the book.
It's frightening, and you think, well, this must, this can't be happening. No, people just can't be like this, but they are. And when you read that, then you really don't wonder about the riots and all. You think, well, gee. It's funny it isn't worse. How come it isn't worse?
Well, when we got into this project, someone wanted me to do it. We were really, really shaken by one couple. Matter of fact, they're godparents to one of our children. We got some terrible opposition from these people. We've known it for 10 years. And they just, Carol can tell me more about that than I can.
I'll tell you one thing, don't ever discuss racial problems over the telephone. That was the biggest mistake. You've got to see a person's face to know how they're reacting. And unless you know how they're reacting, you don't know how to say what you want to say. And it's great to stand up for what you believe, and you've got to put it in the way you can get through to them without, you know, having this blank front that you're being intentional.
Yeah, the problem is probably all going to have to face that. Some of our best friends, maybe
this. You know, I've been listening to this discussion, surprisingly, really. I've been a dentist for over 43 years in Portland, and my practice is 85% Negro, and I think you're misjudging them so badly. Those people have just as many prejudices as some of you do.
Oh, yes, right. They do.
And these people have told us that if they
want to go to a Lutheran church, they'll find it, but they want their own churches. Birds of a feather flock together, and they'll pass up two Negro dentists within a mile of my office, and they come to me.
Why is that?
I don't know. They like me. They like me. I treat them like I do anybody else. There's no color as far as I'm concerned, and that's what the way to treat them. You can't force these things on those people.
It isn't so much.
No, we're not trying to force anything on anybody. I didn't think we were putting this across.
Don't try to bring about too great a change, too quick a change. Let these things kind of take their course and they'll work out peaceably. They're just as worried about racial situations as some of you are. I'm not
sure they are, because we don't have to worry about it.
I talk religion, I talk church and the economics, everything else, and these people, they're reasonable people. They're just as concerned about their uneducated and their churchless people as anybody. They're trying to get
them. Can they do as much about it?
Sure they do.
They're within their own community, but I don't think they can do anything within the way.
Well, what are you going to do about this radical movement, though, that black power is winning out?
Well, black power is not winning out in Portland. It's losing out. There's no black power in Portland that they're aware of at all.
But black power is a very, I think...
I mean, I'm using a nasty term now. Black power, I believe, is very strong.
Well,
the military power there in Portland at all.
There's too much good sense among the people in Portland to let that thing take over. There was a very little bit of a disturbance there last year, and very little damage done. A few windows were broken, a glass door in a bank was broken by a rock. There were rocks around the street the following morning, but very little trouble. And the people there tell me that there's not going to be anything like that this year at all.
Well, that's what they said about Milwaukee, too, about 3 or 4 years ago.
Do you think that the people there have equal opportunity as far as employment?
Oh, surely they do. They're holding down good jobs in any line. The bank where I deal, two blocks from my office, has... out of the total staff there, probably 30, it has, I would say, 6 or 8 at least Negroes. The Negroes are opening their own bank a mile and a half from my office. They're selling shares, open their own bank, and some of the people are drawing the money out of the savings accounts and investing in that bank. They're holding down good jobs in the steel mills and other industries, rug cleaning plants, janitorial services, everything like that. They may have one foot off, shouldn't they?
The Washington area at least is, has a different reaction, a different feeling than San Francisco or around San Francisco, certainly, and certainly Chicago. And I don't know perhaps Portland is the same way. But this isn't across the country. I mean, these riots are a reaction that is necessary, I think, because these people don't have the opportunity.
Well, you've had riots in the Berkeley campus and all other places like that. There is a force behind these riots. I don't think it's a, I don't think it's the natural Negro, it might say. There's agitation promoting these things.
The force behind the riots is despair.
They have to do something.
I'd be a black going to if I lived in it.
Sure. If I were in the same position, I would be fighting tooth and nail to get what I wanted.
Somebody spoke before about a Negro family church. We had one family in our church. They never brought any of their Negro friends to our church.
We
canvassed neighborhoods and have had canvasses. The Portland Lutheran Council had a citywide canvass some years ago, and their names were sent to all the various churches to canvass. There's been follow-up. There's been no increase in our Negro membership. And the Negroes down in the area around my office, I think there was probably some 40, 50 churches there within an area of maybe a mile and a half long, north to south, and three quarters of a mile from east to west. Lots of churches there, storefront churches and things like that. There's all kinds of opportunity for them to hear the gospel of various sorts and have their type of religion that they like.
No, we're not trying to bring the gospel to our church.
Wait a minute now, it's been a dialogue, let me say a word here. But these people, the people that are the troublemakers and so forth, are not the people that are going to those churches, and the Negroes themselves will tell you that.
No. Our point was not to bring them into our church unless they particularly wanted to come in.
Sure.
It was to get ourselves involved in how we could help them in whatever ways, and we found several, to help an employment, to get the people in our church concerned so that they would hire the unemployed.
But you have employers in your church?
We have many. Yeah. We have many people in business who could be involved if they were taught. And a part of the Human Relations Committee is to teach the people in our church to try and get some of these people that have a beginning interest to try to educate them.
Yeah,
and we have become educated through this. And also to those who are interested to go out and pop up, give us a chance to become involved with not only the Negro churches, but also other white churches who are involved in civil service or types of organization. In other words, a way for us to get involved. It's our need as much as theirs. A thing we can do or help these people in some ways. We don't care if they come and join our church. I doubt if they want to. It's a long ways from where they live, you see. But we do want to become involved in the community affairs.
Or to know how you are all already involved in institutional racism, you know. I mean, I think a lot of people, they don't hate Negroes, you know, feeling religious. But you realize how our participation in certain things is institutional racism, how we support the education board, Board of Education, which continues racism, or how we have a mayor or something, or, you know, how in a broader sense,